So, welcome to your second class of this overview of British history. And today I'm going to move forward from 1066, and indeed 1066. I know that in French, 1515, c'est la date que tout le monde connaît. And in England, it's 1066. In fact, there was even a humorous book written. No, please leave it open. There was even a humorous book written many years ago called 1066 and All That, which was a humorous history of Britain. So we're going to really be looking then at the Middle Ages. We already began the Middle Ages last week. Of course, when people were living in the Middle Ages, they didn't know they were in the Middle Ages. Ils se sont pas dit, comment vous trouvez le 13e siècle? Bon, moyen. C'est le Moyen Âge. Non, ce n'est pas du tout ça. Oui, c'était pas très bon, d'accord. Il n'y a pas de date exacte for the Middle Ages, but certainly the Middle Ages is after the end of the Roman Empire, but before the Renaissance. The Renaissance, when ideas of classical antiquity, Archimedes, Plato, Epicurus, Galen, were rediscovered, and the power of the church and religious ideology began to decline in the face of a more scientific view of the world. So I want to move from then the Norman invasion of 1066. Now, this has a certain importance because this is the last time that Britain was invaded, 1066. And many people think that this has an attitude on the insular, this has an effect on the insular attitudes of the British. Maybe it's true. So William the Conqueror, who was who came from Normandy, in fact, in many ways, they were Vikings who had come to Normandy and settled. You have the famous guy in Rouen, Hollo. He was one of the ancestors. And William, who was well known as William the Bastard, and he didn't like this nickname, so he thought, if I conquer England, maybe they'll call me William the Conqueror. And in fact, he was quite successful in that. William the Conqueror defeated King Harold, and this story is famously told in the Bayeux tapestry. If you're ever near Bayeux, the very, very long tapestry tells in pictures a propaganda version of this story. Now, when William arrives in England, he has only 6,000 soldiers. It's not like modern war. It's much smaller things, and William probably won because he had more professional soldiers, even though many of them were not at all nationalists. They were mercenaries. They were paid. He then gradually took over the rest of England in unsurprisingly a very violent manner. There is an episode which historians have always called the Harrying of the North. Le harcèlement du Nord, which really was genocide. There were some rebellions. The biggest rebellion was in the north of England in 1069, led by Edgar and joined by the Danish and the Scottish armies. But William was successful, and he went through the north, burning the animals and the villages, and just generally being a conqueror. Now, the Normans left many traces in Britain today, notably the castles and the cathedrals. The invasion was very different from previous invasions because the elite, the aristocracy, continued to speak French. So for several centuries, the elite spoke French and the ordinary people spoke English. This was a complete invasion. Very quickly, a quarter of the whole of England was owned by 11 men, none of whom spoke English. Bonjour, monsieur. Je vais continuer. Je rattraperai avec les images plus tard. Merci, monsieur. Now, the Normans were very impressive architects. Half of the Tower of London was built by William's men. But being king at the time was very different from today. The king moved around the country all the time. He couldn't stay in the same place because he had to constantly check who was loyal, who was not loyal, who to give more land to, who to give less land to. And every year the king had three big feasts which brought together the aristocracy. William's problem is that he was king because he won a battle. And if you are king because you won a battle, you might lose the next one. So it always has to be very careful to avoid potential revolts. So, for example, when he decided to give 10,000 acres to one aristocrat, he would give them a bit in Yorkshire, a bit in Northumberland, and a bit in the south, because you don't want there to be any base for a possible revolt. William did one thing to make historians very happy. He ordered a catalogue of all the villages and farms in England. This is what we call the Doomsday Book, D-U-M-E-S-D-A-Y, the Doomsday Book. It's many volumes, and it lists literally all the villages and towns and how many cattle they have, how rich they are, and so on. Now, of course, he didn't have this written to help the historians. He had it written to see how much tax he could ask for. Yes, it was a tax book. This is a very extraordinary document, because for most countries we don't have much information at this time, and for England we have almost every village. So, for example, the entry for one town called Dunwich shows that it was one of the largest ports on the east coast, with a thriving fishing industry, and it shows that it paid. Please, dites-moi, monsieur.
Du coup, faut que j'ouvre le coffre complètement. Je le ferai après le cours, hein, pour vous déranger. Est-ce que vous voulez que je vous apporte un vidéo projecteur?
Ce serait très gentil. Hein. Et aussi une extension, parce que là, oui, une rallonge, parce qu'en fait, oui, si vous voulez bien, merci. Ok. So the tax which this town paid was 68,000 herrings a year. Now, this is not surprising. This is before the money economy was dominant. Most exchanges were not happening in money in the 11th century. Already in 1086, when the Doomsday Book is finished, there are approximately... Yes?
68,000 what?
Say again?
68,000 what?
Herrings, fish. Herrings, des ahons, des ahons.
Ah.
We've it, of course, yeah. Don't you pay your tax in herrings?
Oh,
what a modern person. Yeah, 68,000 herrings. Yeah, literally. Now, this is kind of amusing the way, because what does the king do with 68,000 herrings when you have no fridge? Yeah? Say again?
He stores a feast for his
aristocrat. He has a big feast, yeah. How long does a herring last outside a refrigerator? Not very much, yeah? So, dried herring and salted herring, yeah? Not having a fridge is really quite bad news, especially if you have 68,000 herrings. In fact, by 1086, when the Doomsday Book was finished, there were approximately the same number of towns and villages as there were 800 years later. That is to say that there was no really empty land. It was all the places which could be settled were settled. And what happens in the next two centuries is mostly reclaiming marshes and forests, marshes, les marais, which with the new technology could be drained, and you could find new farmland from land which was previously marshes, and also forests, cutting down forests. Cutting down forests is not a modern activity. In the 12th century, they were very good at it. One last thing from the Doomsday Book census: 10% of England's population in 1086 was slaves. 10% were slaves. Okay, so slavery was still something around, and of course I'm sure you understand this, but the slaves are mostly either enemies in war or very much a lot of Welsh slaves, and so on and so forth. Okay, now the Doomsday Book had to do a lot of calculations to work out the tax, and of course they didn't have modern calculations, so they used the abacus, qu'on dit parfois en français boulier chinois. And this was the technology of the time. Now, I was mentioning that the money economy had not yet really dominated, and for example, the king's servants and the king's ministers were paid in a rather special way. The king's chancellor, the accountant, if you like, was paid every day 5 shillings, one best quality loaf and 2 ordinary loaves, one measure of best wine and one of ordinary wine, one wax candle and 40 candle ends. 40 bouts de chandelle, c'est l'origine de l'expression des économies de bouts de chandelle. This was his salary every day. Now, of course, this seems unusual to us, but he was very pleased because if you had money, there were very, very few shops, yeah? And so it's much better to receive bread and wine to keep you going. Indeed, a lot of the rest of society is based on traditional duties. That is to say that this village or this monastery, they had the right to farm all this land if they repaired the bridge every year. This kind of everything was written down, but it was all traditional duties, which is not as efficient as money. And the next 200, 300 years is the rise of the money economy. The king had an awful lot of servants. One servant, and they had very specific responsibilities. For example, there was a servant to dry the king's clothes. It was his job to dry the king's clothes. Another had to organize the king's bath every month. And many people were employed to hunt for the king. Because again, if you don't have refrigeration, then if you're going to have a big feast, you have to kill the animals the day before, maybe 2 days before, or maybe a week before if you're cooking them. And so there was a lot of hunters going out every day for rabbits and deer. However, people ate very badly. Even the rich people ate badly. Rich people often ate only meats and almost no vegetables. This was because there were many things they did not know about how the body works. Sugar was a rare luxury. Now, in this society, religion continued to be extremely important. Every castle, every manor had a chapel. And if you were rich enough, you had your personal priest. You've always wanted a personal priest, haven't you? Okay. This system was relatively stable, but there were wars between William and the population of Wales and the population of Scotland. Just like the Romans, they had difficulty stabilizing the population of Wales and the population of Scotland. There are modern signs of this, because in Wales there are a number of very strong castles with enormous thick walls like this. And you can see immediately that although the Normans in the 12th, 13th, 14th century controlled Wales, they didn't feel safe. So they had this incredibly enormous thing. The walls are thick like this. And of course they were frightened of... when they were attacked, they would throw boiling water on top of the people. Not oil, it's too expensive. It's a myth, the boiling oil thing. And boiling water is enough to persuade you to stop climbing the wall, don't you think? Yes, I think so. Oui, si, oui, s'il vous plaît. S'il vous plaît. Il est allumé, on va voir. C'est très gentil. Panique. This is also the age of the cathedrals. York Minster, which is one of the biggest cathedrals in Europe, is in York. It's approximately the same size as two other cathedrals in Europe, Seville and Cologne, je crois que vous dites. Yeah. So these are obviously intended to impress the entire society. Obviously, they're intended to impress the enemy, but they also intimidate the entire population. When you're a peasant from the 14th century and you go to town and you see the cathedral, you can it's even impressive today. So you can imagine when you live in a wooden house. Also, the cathedral contains the highest technology of the society. First of all, a clock. A clock is incredibly high-tech and advanced for the 12th, 13th century. Most people, of course, tell the time from the sun. And to see this clock, which very sophisticated clocks, is very good. Second huge piece of technology in the church. Anybody? What's the second incredibly advanced technology in the Middle Ages in the church, and only in the church? Even today, they are often impressive. The what?
The bell?
It's an idea. The organ. Yeah, the organ. Now, the organs of the 13th century were not as impressive as the ones we see today are mostly, in the big cathedrals, are mostly 18th, 19th century, or unrepaired since. These are 30, but nevertheless, they were something absolutely incredible. And indeed, the clock shows evidence of, yes, c'est magnifique, c'est la magie, presque. Oui, je crois que, bon, oui, c'est ça, hein. Alors, si je vais le mettre en plein, je vais le mettre en route.
Voilà, ça fonctionne. Ah,
merci beaucoup, monsieur. Voilà. Oui, parce que la semaine dernière, on n'était pas ici, alors on n'a pas pu savoir qu'il ne marchait plus.
Voilà.
Je vous le ramène, hein.
Voilà,
je vous
ramène avec tout. Le câble HDMI que j'ai ramené en avec.
Bien sûr. À tout à l'heure, monsieur. Laissez ouvert, s'il vous plaît. Voilà. Ne paniquez pas, tout va bien se passer. Je déteste ça quand ça marche pas. Alors, moi je dois bouger un peu, sinon je ne veux pas bloquer. Bon, je vais bouger un peu de temps en temps. Okay, so just to catch up on the pictures, then there we have the map of Britain in 1066, and a little part of the Bayeux tapestry which tells the story. That's the Tower of London, which was built in the 11th century. So yeah, and they were considered to be extremely good. What's the word? Architects. The Domesday Book looks like that. About 1085. This is the list of all the places and how many fish they have and how many sheep they have. The inside of it looks like that. Yeah, it's written in Latin. No surprises there. I think it's written in Latin. Yes. These are the castles today, which were built in Wales, because the Normans did not feel so secure. And you can see that this is today, so it lasted 800 years, so it's a pretty powerful thing. My favourite one, Rutland Castle. My father loved these, and when I was six, he took me to all the castles in Wales. Rutland Castle again. That's another one, I can't remember, Pembroke, I think. So the cathedrals, began in 1080, so this is we're fairly slightly different style, but fairly similar to in France. 100 years later, I think Notre Dame in Paris will be built. I don't know when Rouen Cathedral was built, but it's similar. That's York Minster. I'm just moving up forward and backward just to not block the same person all the time. Salzburg Cathedral, Köln Cathedral in Germany. This is my favourite cathedral, and they built it just next to the railway station so people could see it when they were changing trains. That was good thinking on the part of the architect, wasn't it? Okay. The cathedral clock. So this is a little later. This is a 15th century clock. And although it's pretty, it's more impressive when you've never seen a clock in your life. Occasionally, the architecture of the town would show conflict. Here you have, I think it's in Norwich, here you have in St. Albans, a clock tower built in 1403, in the beginning of the 15th century. It's very significant because it's not in a church. It was very rare to have a clock which was not in a church. And in fact, this is a sign that the local people were a bit angry with the church and wanted to assert their independence. So let's go back to the political history of Norman England. There were some revolts, and there was worries among the aristocracy that the king was taking too much power. And one of the effects of this was the aristocracy obliged the king in 1215, King John, to sign the Magna Carta, the Great Charter. And this is one of the vous avez vaguement entendu parler, hein? Vous avez oublié la moitié de ce qu'on vous a dit dessus. C'est ça. Oui, c'est parfait. C'est ce que j'avais compris. It is very important because it's immediate effect was not great. King John signed it, but he wasn't serious, and so he broke it immediately. So it wasn't very, very it didn't have a great practical effect immediately. But from a historical point of view, very much, for the first time, it introduces the idea of trial by jury. Now, they're talking about the rights of the elite, not the rights of everybody, but nevertheless. It also established a committee of barons who could veto the decisions of the king. Now, the king signed it, but did not follow it. Some of the paragraphs of this document will be used again in the constitutions at the French Revolution and at the American Revolution. And I believe that the most recent time was some of the African constitutions for the new independent countries in the 1960s. They took paragraphs from the Magna Carta, so we're very proud that they took it. You can see it in London in the British Library. So let's have a look at the social structure, and let's have a look a little bit at the aristocrats. These are the barons and the knights. We're now in the 14th century approximately, and these were this is the golden age of the knights. This is the chevalier, the golden age of the knights. If you were the youngest son of a baron, you would become a knight and be obliged to fight, and the king will give the knights land in exchange for military service. And one of the great pastimes of the knights was the tournaments and all the here we have the tournaments. And you know, we see fictional representations of these, but they were very very important. The first ones, these were organized by the king and the feudal lords for public celebrations. The first ones took place in France in the 9th century, and soon afterwards the fashion spread to Germany and England. They could be very big. The number of participants was unlimited. There could be 2,000 participants in a tournament, and the tournaments could last for 4 days. The winners gained a lot of prestige, but these were secular festivals, and the church, and in particular the Pope, was not too happy with it. The Pope denounced the tournaments. People continued anyway. They said, "Oh yes, yep, sure, Mr. Pope, no problem," but they continued anyway. Now the Pope denounced the tournaments because the Pope had another idea for what the knights should be doing. Anybody know what the Pope wanted the knights to do? The Crusades. Yeah, go and get Palestine back from the Muslims. Yeah, this was the big thing. Go and get Constantinople. Yeah, get Constantinople back, which today is Istanbul, which today is Istanbul. In any case, the popes would often ban the tournaments, but this was not very effective. And they introduced into Britain the idea of the coat of arms, le blason, which is a French idea, and indeed in English the vocabulary to describe your coat of arms or the coat of arms of your school or university is French vocabulary. They use French vocabulary today in English for that. If you were a knight, you had a series of duties, the most important one was military service. But one of the signs of the rise of the money economy is that little by little, the knights were allowed to give money instead of military service. They were allowed to pay money instead of military service. Looking at the economy, a lot of the forests were disappearing, but they were still very, very big. The wolves were disappearing, the wild boar were disappearing. Même aujourd'hui, quand on dit aux Anglais que voilà qu'il y a danger de sanglier dans certaines parties de la France, il y a un roule en voiture, les gens sont étonnés. Ils disent, mais les sangliers, c'était avant le 15e siècle, non? On a pas de cause sanglier. Now, the forests are still very big, and they are very useful for ordinary people. That's where you go to get the firewood. That's where you go to get wild honey. That's where you go to get deer and rabbits and fruits. However, of course, if you go and get deer and rabbits, it may be illegal. The forests officially belong to the king, and he sets up special tribunals, forest tribunals, to stop people from taking things from the forest. Sometimes the punishment was very cruel. You could be executed if you stole a deer. There are many folk songs about this. The kings were trying to protect the forests against the advance of agriculture, but this was really not possible in the long term. The plough was the future, la charrue, what's the future. We also have the very beginning of enclosures, because common land, quite a lot of the land was common land. It belonged to nobody, and the ordinary people could use it. And this land was gradually privatized, very gradually, over 500 years, was gradually let. And the king would say, oh, this common land, it's not common land anymore. It belongs to my friend, the Duke. The technology was getting better. So people were hungry less often, but it was difficult to find food in the winter. They did have some problems, because some of the best vegetables for surviving the winter, and I think you don't know this, I didn't know, the best vegetables for surviving the winter are turnips and swedes. C'est le navet et le rutabaga. Now, they're not very tasty, but they grow in the winter. And that's when you need food, yeah, and you can feed your animals. As the turnips when the turnips and the swedes arise, it's no longer necessary to kill all your animals in October, because you have what you need to feed them. The population is rising. We think that in the 11th century there were 2 million, and in the 14th century 5 million. That's a very, very important rise. So, if the population rises from 2 to 5 million, this means either the agriculture was better or the medicine was better. The medicine was not better. It was the agriculture. Medicine at the time was very useful. Now, as for medicine, as Christianity grew in influence, there was a tension between church and folk medicine. A lot of the ordinary people relied on magic and magicians for medicine, whereas the church wanted them to pray to get better. Indeed, the church thought that God sometimes sent illness as a punishment, and if you repented, you could lead to recovery. In the Middle Ages, some people considered that Christians should not be doctors, because disease comes from God. Some people thought that Christians shouldn't go against this, but not all Christians, because many monastic orders, particularly the Benedictines, concentrated on looking after the sick. So how did this food and medicine work out? Well, life expectancy at birth was 31. The average life expectancy was 31. However, the most dangerous period was when you were a little child. If you arrived to the year of 10, if you arrived to 10 years old, on average you would reach 42. Okay, so the second main danger was dying in a hunting accident or in manual labour. But there was one thing which was even more dangerous than war, even more dangerous than hunting, and even more dangerous than manual labour. What was it? The biggest cause of death at this time. And this particularly concerns the people in this room, most of you. Yeah, childbirth, having babies. Yeah, the death rate was huge. You know, it's like, you know, 25% of women who died having babies, something like that. That's not a precise thing. So between the age of 14 and the age of 40, life expectancy was lower for women. Because children very often died, people had a lot of babies, and this was extremely dangerous. This is one of the reasons that a lot of young women said, "Oh, I think I'll become a nun and go and live in a convent." It was actually safer; you would live longer. When you'd seen three or four people around you dying on their first or second baby, you say, "I like babies, but I like being alive." Yeah, so convents were an option here. We're now moving to the end of the Middle Ages, and I just want to say a couple of things about the 14th century. The huge event of the 14th century was the Black Death. Alors je sais pas pourquoi je n'ai pas un. There you go, the Black Death. Ils vont pas bien. C'est clair. the Black Death. Now the Black Death came back from time to time. This is the plague, la peste, and the biggest of the plagues was 1348. Excuse me a moment. It's the mask here doesn't help. 25 million people died in Europe of the plague in 1348. Around 30% of the population across Europe, and about 30% of the population in Britain. Yeah, pandemia, c'est beaucoup plus grave qu'aujourd'hui. Heureusement que c'est moins grave aujourd'hui. But this did not only have a horrific experience for people, but it also had an economic effect. The landowners could no longer find enough workers for their farms. And when you can't find enough workers, wages rise. Because if you're not paying enough, then the worker says, oh, I think I'll go to the next village. And it's also very difficult to find them again, because this is not an information society. For the first time, the king got very worried, or the aristocrats got very worried about rising wages, and for the first time in history, they wrote a law saying that it is illegal to pay higher wages than 40 years ago. It was illegal to have a higher. But because the landowners needed people on their farm, and otherwise their farm was no good, it didn't actually work. But it was the very, very first attempt at limiting wages by law. The other huge event of the 14th century, which we have heard again about recently, is the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. 1381, enormous peasants' revolt against the poll tax. Now, what is a poll tax? A poll tax is the idea, it's a tax which is the same amount for everybody. Yeah? £100 for each person. And the reason you've already heard this is that when in the 1990s Margaret Thatcher introduced a new idea that the local tax should be the same amount for everybody, whether your house is big or poor or small, the opposition said, well, that's just like the poll tax in the 14th century. And so people came to know the tax as the poll tax. It also has a meaning in the United States. And a revolt began. The revolt began when one village refused to pay the tax and threw the tax collector in the river. This is the way you did things at the time, yeah? The rebels from Kent and Essex walked all the way to London. They broke into a prison and released one of their leaders, John Ball, a radical priest. They occupied the Tower of London and killed the Archbishop of Canterbury. So, you know, this was a really pretty cool revolt for the time. And the king was obliged to negotiate. However, when the leader of the rebels, Wat Tyler, went to meet the king, they killed him. If you're organizing a peasant revolt, don't trust the king. Remember this. This will be useful to you. And so, of course, the revolt is crushed. But it tells us a lot about society at the time. If you have a social revolt at the time, the vocabulary of the social revolt is religious. And here's the most important sentence today. Religion and politics are the same thing. Not today, but in the 14th century. Now that sounds bizarre. Religion and politics are the same thing. But at this time, it's a very religious society. Everybody believes in God. And so if you want a different society, you say, God wants a different society. I have heard voices from God and he says he wants a different society. Or God wrote the Bible and in the Bible it says the society should be different. And the people who don't want change say, no, the present society is the society that God wants. Everything becomes an argument about God because religion is the way that people understand the world. And so to say, I want a different religion, because the church is so powerful and the church and the king work together, if you say I want a different religion, it means I want a different society, and vice versa. And famously, the leaders of the peasant revolt were very interested in the ideas of John Ball, the radical priest. And I have a little quotation from John Ball, the radical priest. Does anybody know this quotation? Okay. I'll translate it. Yeah. One Adam Dalf and Iverspen, who was then the gentleman. very, very short, yeah, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? Quand Adam creusait la terre et Eve, je ne sais pas ce qu'elle faisait avec les fils, c'était qui l'aristo à l'époque? Extremely radical, says, look at the Bible, there's no aristocrats in the Bible at the beginning of humanity, let's get rid of them. It's an extremely radical idea that in the Bible you don't have aristocrats and slaves, so you know, let's get rid of them. And so for John Ball was a very radical priest. For him, the Bible and not the church was the center of religion. Now, today, if we hear somebody saying, oh, society should be based on the Bible, we know that they are somebody who's very conservative. At the time, the people who said society should be based on the Bible were revolutionaries. Because they said, not the church, not the king, but this or no. Oh, Jesus says, Jesus says, treat everybody equally. Oh, yes, let's have that. And so they used the Bible for this. And this this was involved with one of the religious revolts at the time. There are a lot of religious revolts. You may have heard, I think it's a little bit later, you may have heard of the revolt of the Cathars in France, les Cathars, it's fairly well known. C'est la même chose, on a entendu parler, on a oublié les trois quarts. There were frequently heretical revolts against the church. And in the 14th century, there were the Lollards in Britain, L-O-2-L-A-R-D. L-O-2-L-A-R-D. And what they did was they translated the Bible into English. Okay, the translator. This was a huge challenge to the church. The whole principle of the church is the Bible is in Latin, so you ordinary people, you don't understand it. The priest will tell you what it means, and the bishop will tell the priest, and the pope will tell the bishop. It's a hierarchy. You're not important. If you translate the Bible into English, it's this new idea which later will become the base of Protestantism. What is important is your individual relationship with God. You are important to God. Whereas the traditional idea is, you're important, but, you know, the priest is more important, that the bishop is even more important, and so on and so forth. So translating the Bible into English was, in fact, revolutionary. And the Lollards also protested because the church was very corrupt. They denied any special authority to the priesthood. They said, "We know priests are not different. We're all the same in front of God." In the 14th century, this is a good way to get executed. Yeah, incidentally. And there you have Wycliffe. Yeah, Mr. Wycliffe. Where is he? He's one of these, who was the guy who organized the translation of the Bible into English, the Wycliffe translation. The 14th century is also the moment of one of the first great works of English literature, Chaucer. This is still very much studied in Britain, but I don't know if it's so much studied in France these days. I think every now and then it comes back to the Agreg. So the Canterbury Tales was written by Geoffrey Chaucer. It is a fabulous book. It's slightly difficult, the English, but it's a fabulous book. It's full of sarcastic attacks on the church and society. The prioress, the head of the convent, the convent, loved to seduce men in this story. The monk loved hunting and didn't like studying. And the friar, that's another kind of monk, sold confessions. He said, "Oh, you know, if you give me £100 and I'll say that you're absolved." But I just wanted to quote a little six lines from this, which I will translate or explain. A friar there was, a wanton and a merry, a limiter, a very festive man. In all the orders four is none that can equal his gossip and his fair langage. He had arranged full many a mariage of women young, and this at his own cost. Alors il faut comprendre le sarcasme, c'était un moine qui était tellement généreux et fêtard qu'il avait payé pour les fêtes de mariage de plein de jeunes filles, et il avait payé de sa poche. Et vous êtes censé comprendre qu'il y avait une raison qu'il voulait payer le mariage de ces jeunes filles qui étaient déjà enceintes par le moine, c'est ça ce qu'il faut comprendre. Donc, very hard, sarcastic, amusing attacks on the church of the time. And that brings me to the end of the Middle Ages. I have another slide of Chaucer for you to look at, which is here.